Bet365 is paying out before the final whistle.
Check out Bet365's unrivaled early payout offer. When you bet on a team to win and they take a 17-point lead, you get paid no matter the final score. Forget the final whistle and start counting that cash. Hold up. You get early payout on parlays, too.
Download the app and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.
Not coming from Brent Veach and Andy Reid, and it's not coming from Sean McVay. It's coming from the Cleveland Browns. And yeah. You're seeing exactly
you know
what
why
people
it's not,
outside of Cleveland
you know,
think of the Browns, outside of Browns.
You know
fans.
Why it's not coming from those guys? Because they didn't draft him. They didn't want him to begin with. This was the one team that wanted him, and they're telling you he's behind. Maybe it's not a grand conspiracy. Maybe everybody is right, and the Shador fans, you wackos. Maybe it's your guy is just not ready. Maybe you got to come to grips with it.
The Ken Carmen Show with Anthony Lima on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Dr. Mary Claire Haver. Ready for honest conversations about thriving in midlife? Listen to and follow my new podcast, Unpaused, available now wherever you get your podcasts.
Well, if you're just getting up, it's about 67 degrees outside, going up to 80 today, and it's going to be around 80 degrees, maybe a little bit warmer through the weekend, and then a chance for showers next week as a cool front comes in. It's going to knock the high temperatures down to about 73 or so by next Halloween, by next Friday, which is Halloween. So it's not going to really be chilly, but it's not going to be hot either. So there you go, with lows around 58 or so. You can keep that in mind as you plan on your costume. One thing I just noticed, Halloween's on a Friday this year, so I guess it will be a little bit bigger than usual when it's on a weeknight. Mark Hamrick joins us now, our friend, Bankrate senior analyst, to talk about the maybe an AI bubble. How you doing, Mark?
Doing well, my friend. Good morning to you.
Let's talk about, first off, before we get to AI bubble, what is a bubble in the market?
A bubble is perceived to be a part of a historical phenomenon where the price of something becomes inflated so much that it's at risk of popping at some point. And you could make an argument that the housing market nationally was bubbly around 2006 before we had the housing bust. You could make the argument that Beanie Babies back in the day,
there
30 years ago.
You know me and my Beanie Babies, Mark. You know me. There you go.
You know, I don't mean to trigger you on the whole Beanie Baby
that's
thing.
Okay.
We could go all New Orleans on you and talk about Pappy Van Winkle.
There you go. Or the bourbon and also IPOs, right? We had a bubble with those because it seems like everybody was having these. I don't know if that was a bubble or not, but I was having lunch with somebody on Friday, and it seemed as though back in the day, you know, we had groceries.com, we had carrots.com, we had candybars.com, and everybody was going crazy with these IPOs, and then they went belly up shortly thereafter, but they got to keep the money, right, that they raised?
Well, what you're talking about there really is the dot-com bubble running up until 2000. And what was different from that, from the current situation where we're talking about stocks that have benefited from the many billions of dollars invested in artificial intelligence. We're talking about NVIDIA. We're talking about Microsoft. We're talking about Alphabet, which is the parent of Google. We're talking about Meta, the parent of Facebook. We're talking about Amazon, Apple, and perhaps to some degree Tesla. Those are the stocks that are seen in this group that you're talking about at the outset here. But back in the late 90s and into 2000, these were companies for the most part that did not have positive cash flow, didn't have profitability. And so, you know, you can't say that about NVIDIA, Microsoft, .. But what you can question is, how rich have these stock prices become when NVIDIA's run up 1,000% in 3 years as sort of a prime example? The problem with the answer that we try to attach to the question is, we don't know where and when this ends, meaning when does it deflate? And so that's really what the challenge is for everybody who's watching this, is these things can last for a long time. And the most important part of the answer is, trying to time it is nearly impossible.
Don't get stuck holding the Beanie Babies, but how do you know when, right?
Exactly. That's exactly right.
So what does the future look like for AI, because it would seem as though it is ever expanding, and you would think that AI would generate more AI. So if you put money in AI, more AI is going to be developed and be used. So as a result, it's a can't lose thing. But that's what a lot of people think, right?
Well, there will be losers, right? In other words, not every solution will be successful. And if, for those of us that are, dare I say, sufficiently senior enough to remember the emergence of the internet and the dot-coms, many of the first movers in that space did not either survive or succeed. And so Google is a great example of sort of being a second generation email and search platform where many preceded it and failed or went away. You know, I can remember back in the day there were platforms that I liked or used, including Excite. There was Ask Jeeves. There was, of course, Yahoo, which is still around, but in a much shrunken form. And Google sort of emerged and took over the personal email space, but most importantly, search. And now AI is there's going to be a sorting out process here as well. And so not every dollar invested is going to have either a return or a superior return. And that's the way the business world works, as we all know, whether it's the mom and pop restaurant down the street or technology.
This is a competitive environment, Mark. So when it comes to the winners and the losers, what separated, say, the winners from the Ask Jeeves and the Yahoos?
Some degree timing, some degree luck, some degree sustainable strategy that was envisioned and executed by the management. And in some cases, it was just, you know, they all cannot survive, right? In other words, at some point, there's going to be a sorting out in almost every marketplace. And that'll be true with these as well. But, you know, as I look at that list that I just cited to you, is there any company among those that I would really want to substantially bet against? No. But I also wouldn't say that if you put $1,000 into any of those stocks and expect that level to be sustained, let's say, over the next 12 to 24 months, the stock market will be due for a correction at some point. A correction is a decline of 10%. A bear market is a decline of 20%. It'll go through that, and these stocks will be part of that. But many will be still standing some years from now. And so what we counsel people at Bankrate, meaning our audience and by extension your audience, to think about is this is really a long-term game that we're trying to play with investing. You know, we've talked very often about our surveys at Bankrate that, for example, thinking about the fact that most Americans have exposure to the stock market for the reason of saving for their retirement, that's a long-term proposition. If you're exposed or invested in, let's say, a mutual fund that is linked to the S&P 500 index, that has a lot of exposure to AI. And if and when there is a correction, it will suffer a bit of a setback, but it will also be helping to drive a part of the success of the performance of the stock market and the broader economy in the future.
You can drill down on exposure to AI, why there is so much exposure when we get back. We're talking to Mark Hamrick, Bankrate Senior Economic Analyst, about an AI bubble. You got any questions, comments, 504-260-1870. CEO Conor Jeweler Talk and Text Line, please know driving and texting ever. Right now it's time for WWL Traffic. 625, Tommy Tucker, WWL, back with Mark Hamrick, Bankrate Senior Economic Analyst. You were talking about exposure to AI when it comes to people with their 401ks or stock market, right, Mark, before?
Exactly, yeah.
Explain that. Go into that a little bit in detail.
Well, a good number of companies in the corporate universe have investment or exposure to artificial intelligence. They're using it in their business. And then there are the companies that are working to develop it that we talked about at the outset, NVIDIA being the chip maker and technology company, but companies including the parents of Facebook, of Google, including Microsoft and others, are seen as part of the so-called Magnificent Seven, or the core group of companies that are developing AI and are seen as the beneficiaries of this technology as the rest of the world uses it. So, you know, insofar as, you know, some years ago, the great Warren Buffett said, if you're going to do two things to invest successfully, and this applies to those who are using their 401ks to save for retirement, it's basically two things. A typical S&P 500 mutual fund that has low costs associated with it, You hold on to that for the duration, as well as some exposure to treasury bonds. Those are two things. And so the S&P 500, being the sort of mainstream stock market index representing some of the largest and most successful companies in the universe, has substantial, skin in the game with respect to AI. And so if you're using an S&P 500 mutual fund, you have investment in artificial intelligence, whether you intended that to be the case or not. And so one of the questions for any investor right now, whether it's, you know, anybody listening, what their 401ks, what they're doing with their retirement savings, or somebody who loves picking stocks, is should you be diversifying now because there has been such a gargantuan run-up in these AI stocks? And the answer is probably, but that doesn't mean to dump out of them, but it means to sort of look at the fact that an NVIDIA is up 1,000% in 3 years and say, you know, everybody likes taking a profit. Maybe you just need to move some of that money around a little bit to have less substantial exposure to AI, which no doubt is going to be, still in the race for the foreseeable future.
So I started talking about the dot-com bubble, or at least I mentioned it. And I see a story in the Wall Street Journal about circularity, buzzword, and artificial intelligence deals. Talk about that, and does that lend itself to maybe comparisons with the dot-com bubble?
Well, there will always be comparisons because, first of all, the dot-com bubble, which, you know, was associated with the great enthusiasm of investing in something that was quite revolutionary, and that was the emergence of the Internet and the fact that, you know, in the 1980s or early 1990s, you would have had a hard argument to make to people to say you should have a personal computer, and now we all carry one. I'm talking on one to you right now, the iPhone. So the comparisons will be made, but there are, as I mentioned earlier, stark differences in the sense of these major companies such as NVIDIA, Microsoft, Google, are making profit from this. The question is, you know, how many companies will earn a substantial return on their investment, and at what point does some of this investment run cold? And that's a legitimate question, and it isn't totally answerable at the moment from the standpoint of we need to see how history works out, much the same as, you know, you were fine riding the horse until the dot-com bubble imploded, and the same will be true of this. There will be some losses, but exactly how that unfolds, and most importantly, the timing, it's literally impossible to say.
Is there any way to predict who's going to be the winners, or what is going to determine winners and losers?
The quick answer is no.
Okay.
That's essentially it. As I said earlier, with these top seven companies, would you want to make a substantial bet against any of them? Probably not, but that doesn't mean their current stock prices are totally sustainable. But, you know, you think about Apple, which is in this race and also to some degree seen as somewhat behind. People have been trying to bet against Apple forever, and that's been a losing proposition because it has managed to innovate and do remarkable things. The most recent iteration of the iPhone release has ended up being more successful than people predicted. The stock got a bunch of upgrades on Wall Street just this week because of that.
So you wouldn't bet against the Lions or the Chiefs, but they both can't win.
Well, let's just say the score may be different than what we expect.
Thank you. Appreciate it, Mark. Mark Hamrick, senior economic analyst. We'll take a break and back talk with Dub Lane about healthcare right now. Time for WWL First News. For that, we go to Ian Ozan. 6:47, 13 till 7. Quickly to Walter Dub Lane, professor, associate professor of economics and finance at my alma mater, UNO. He is our healthcare go-to guy. How you doing, Dub?
Hey, good morning. Fine, Tim.
I'm looking at the Peter G. Peterson Foundation, which sounds like something from Seinfeld, but it's not. And they're quoted as saying in an August study that Americans pay double what residents in other developed nations pay for health care, even though outcomes in the U.S. are worse than those in other countries, as we all get our, or some of us are getting our open enrollment benefit period, where we can see what's going to happen. It always goes up. The benefits always go down. The price of it goes up. Where's all the money going, Dub?
Well, there's several things involved in there. The healthcare costs are going up for a variety of different reasons. And if you think even at the hospital level, Three major reasons are because it's very labor intensive, and we've certainly been we've had a shortage of things like nurses and radiation technologists and people of that sort, and those shortages tend to drive up wages, which of course becomes the cost of the hospital. The other one is technology. The newest MRIs and CT scans, mammograms, all of those robotic surgery, all of those high tech type of things increase the cost. They're very expensive, and we use a lot more of them than other countries do. And then the third, in terms of not just hospital specifically, but healthcare in general, the biggest increases we've seen have been in pharmaceuticals. Now, some of this is really good news as they keep discovering, you know, these genetic ways of dealing with diseases. I just was reading about one recently about Duchenne's multiple muscular dystrophy. Mm-hmm. Which again, is a possible cure for it, but it costs about $1 million to $3 million for each person. Those are huge costs that are being passed on to this.
So I know you're not a physician, but I'm the average person, I think, would hear that and say, what could possibly cost $1 to $3 million?
Well, again, I can't really get into that much, but the other thing, but you are right in terms of, actually that quote wasn't quite right. We do pay a lot more than most other countries do. Mm-hmm. Now, again, and the best gauge I have that is we're spending upwards right now of 18% of our entire GDP on healthcare. Most other Western countries are spending between 10 to 12%. So we're more like 50 or 60% higher, not twice as much, but still it is substantially higher. And there's a lot of other reasons for that in terms of, again, our use of technology. We pay our physicians a lot more than most other countries do. We're also very inefficient in terms of our administrative costs are much higher. And our pharmaceuticals are much, much higher.
So what are we getting in exchange for that as far as outcomes go?
Well, actually, our outcomes, when they say the outcomes are less, there's usually two. Internationally, there's only a couple of things they measure that they compare of some. Mm-hmm. One of them is longevity. That is, our average life expectancy in the United States is actually a year or two less than most other developed countries. Hmm. Now, that's not because of our poor healthcare system. That's because we have a lot of younger people that die from violence and automobile accidents. Hmm. And whenever that lowers your life expectancy, the way they measure it is just the average rate at which age at which people die. Mm-hmm. So if we have people, a 17-year-old drug dealer gets killed, that lowers our life expectancy down and has nothing to do with our healthcare system. If you adjust for those two things, violence and automobile accidents, then we're comparable to everybody else. But what we do see is on some of our outcomes, like if you want to be treated for cancer and certain type of diseases, we do a much better job than many other countries. So on some measures, we look worse. In some places, we are actually much better.
So when it comes to, I guess, the cost and what we could learn from other countries, to me, it all comes down to, and this goes back to when I first started dealing with all of this, you know, with Obamacare and everything else. If it works for you, you don't want to change it. If it doesn't work for you, you want to change it. Apparently, it's working for enough people where there's not the will to change it, or the people that are really benefiting from this have the power where it doesn't want to change? Are those two accurate statements or not?
Well, and part of it is if you do the surveys, interestingly, show that most people in the United States are very happy with our healthcare system, meaning we feel like we have good doctors and good hospitals. It's very expensive, but we feel like we're getting our money's worth. Now, on the other hand, what's really bad in the United States is we're the only country of the developed countries that doesn't have universal health care, universal insurance. Mm-hmm. That we still have a substantial, even after Obamacare reduced the number of uninsured tremendously, even after that, we still have a substantial percentage of our population, 10 or 12%, that are uninsured. And those uninsured people impose very high costs on everybody else, because they eventually show up in the emergency room and other things, and those costs get passed along to all the rest of us in terms of higher insurance prices and things of that sort.
So
we have a system that's not very efficient.
So if the COVID subsidies go away that the Democrats are fighting for, and that's what they're holding up the government, that's what they're shutting. I hate to say they're shutting down the government, but for whatever reason, that's where they're drawing their line in the sand. If those go away, what happens to the healthcare system for how many Americans?
Well, again, a lot of people will lose their insurance because those subsidies that occur are keeping making health insurance very inexpensive for many people. The subsidies go away, they're going to have to pay a lot more for insurance, and a lot of them will choose not to have insurance, and therefore the uninsured rate will go up.
Which means we ultimately end up paying for that. The cost to everybody goes up because there's no well care. They go to the emergency room, et cetera, et cetera.
Yes.
Okay. So if the subsidies go away, is there any way to measure how much that's going to cost people who still have insurance but are not affected by the subsidies going away but will ultimately end up paying for it?
Well, let me just kind of give you an idea. Right now, the people that have, you know, insurance, Blue Cross, United, all those type of things, those companies, at least, especially for hospitals, pay about 135% of the cost, which is a pretty big premium. Mm-hmm. The reason for that is because Medicare only pays 90% of the cost, Medicaid only pays 65% of the cost, and uninsured pays about 10% of their cost. And so more than about half of all the patients at hospitals lose money on them. And so if the people with good insurance didn't pay those higher premiums, the hospitals would close down.
And so
other countries, everybody has the same insurance. Like Canada has Medicare for all. Now our Medicare wouldn't work that way, but that would level out everything in terms of the people that have the insurance wouldn't have to pay such a premium.
And from the actuarial side of it, if Blue Cross and the other companies are taking in less money for premiums because people can't afford it due to the loss of subsidies, that's going to make our rates go up, right?
We should see some of that, yes.
Okay. Thank you, Doug. Appreciate it. It's complicated, but you make it understandable. Walter Dubland, Associate Professor of Economics and Finance at my alma mater, proud to say UNO, 655, 5 till 7. Let's look at traffic now, WWL. Cloudy, cool start to this Wednesday, October 22nd, 66 degrees outside right now, going up to about 80 today, tomorrow, and Friday, Saturday evening, Sunday morning, chance for showers, highs near 80, then looking ahead to Halloween, highs around 70 degrees.
Listen up, football fans, you won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $200 into something bigger when you bet on Moneyline, Spread, Totals, Player Props.
$200 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In-app only.
Not coming from Brent Veach and Andy Reid, and it's not coming from Sean McVay. It's coming from the Cleveland Browns. And
yeah.
You're seeing exactly
you know
what
why
people
it's not,
outside of Cleveland
you know,
think of the Browns, outside of
you
Browns.
You know why
fans.
It's not coming from those guys? Because they didn't draft him. They didn't want him to begin with. This was the one team that wanted him, and they're telling you he's behind. Maybe it's not a grand conspiracy. Maybe everybody is right, and the Shador fans, you wackos. Maybe it's your guy is just not ready. Maybe you got to come to grips with it.
The Ken Carmen Show with Anthony Lima on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Dr. Mary Claire Haver. Ready for honest conversations about thriving in midlife? Listen to and follow my new podcast, Unpaused, available now wherever you get your podcasts.
Lows in the 50s, and it's not going to be cold, but at least it's not going to be hot either. Let's talk to Jason Wagenspach now. Wagenspach, president of Film Louisiana. How you doing, Jason?
Good, Tommy. Good morning. Thanks for having me back on.
What's the film industry like in Louisiana these days?
Well, we're actually got a little uptick. We've got a couple of shows here on the ground in New Orleans. We got a show in St. Francisville, Baton Rouge right now. We got a couple more looking to get started before the end of the year. Mm-hmm. And we just got back from Hollywood, and looks like we might have a good uptick starting in next year.
Tell me why.
Well, looks like they're starting to come back more domestically. We had a week-long tour of Los Angeles last week with everybody representing Film Louisiana. We had a great showing. about 13 people from our board coming out, really talking about how the benefits of Louisiana are there. And they actually turned around and said, you know what, domestically is where we're going to really try to start looking a little bit more and more prevalent now in 2026.
It would seem with all the different streaming services and the need for content that, man, your business would be going like crazy. Not the case?
You would think so, but I think we've discussed this in the past. It has a lot to do with the mayor that, you know, money is a little bit cheaper and goes a little bit further when you get outside the United States right now at this moment.
Mm-hmm.
But now that you're starting to see a lot more talk around bringing business back into the United States, the film industry is starting to take aim as well and really look at how do we continue bringing more projects back home that we haven't seen here in the last 2 to 3 years. And so we're excited about that.
Does location shooting as opposed to like the CGI stuff matter?
Yeah, of course. All of those factors matter. And you get diverse locations, you know, here in the U.S., especially here in Louisiana with our great climate that we have and the mere fact that, you know, you can double for many and multiple cities here in the state. We actually went out to Los Angeles to really promote the fact that we have a lot of those unique locations. We can double for other countries, other cities. And that's one of the main reasons we're obviously hearing a lot more about how Louisiana is going to make a comeback here real soon.
But how do you compete with foreign countries when it comes to, like you're saying, that the dollar goes farther there or you can get more there?
That's tough. And you're absolutely right. You know, a lot of these countries are sovereign nations and they can write checks, you know, at the blink of an eye to attract more production. But I really think that, again, the talent that we have in the United States, the creative nature that we have built up over the last 100, 150 years of creating content, and the mere fact that, you know, a lot of who we create from and a lot of the people that are part of these creative industries want to stay home. I think they really are starting to realize we have great talent here. Why am I going 12 hours on a flight to actually go and work when I can do it right here at home?
When it comes to the people that are in the business like yourself that have capital investment, I don't know if there's debt service on that. Are you guys hurting right now or not?
Yeah, look, everybody is. I mean, when you have a market that, you know, year over year is going down 50%, everybody across the board is really kind of figuring out how to make things more efficient. They're obviously looking at their bottom line. There's a lot of things that are happening at the moment. And, you know, unfortunately, some of the businesses, you know, have really looked at what does it look like pivoting from outside of the industry. But again, as we see this little bit of uptick that we have here and as we move into 2026 with a brighter future in front of us, I really think that the industry is going to see a nice little bring back and a lot of those debt servicings will start to subside a little bit more.
We'll take a quick break. We'll pick it up. We come back talking to Jason Wagon back about Film Louisiana. He's the president of Film Louisiana. 721 Traffic Now, WWL. 727 and a half, Tommy Tucker, WWL, back with Jason Wagon back with Film Louisiana. Jason, when it comes to the content needed for all the different streaming services, take me through how that whole process works, if you will, because ultimately it comes down to filming in Louisiana, production in Louisiana, your facilities being used, and the ancillary business that Louisiana businesses pick up. So how does it all start? You mentioned a trip to Hollywood. Do the uppity ups at Netflix, at the different production studios, Paramount? You know, so many times a movie comes on and you see 15 different people that are involved with it. Do you have to put together a consortium to produce a project? Then from there you decide where? Take me through it.
Well, it is that. It's a consortium. It does take an army to make a big budget project. And nowadays it varies. It really, you can be an independent filmmaker and do it, you know, with a smaller team and do independent distribution on your own via social media, YouTube, or obviously you can go the studio route, which is, you know, pitching a project to a studio, whether that's the optioning of a book or a life rights, making it into a script, hiring the writer, hiring the filmmaker, or what we call the director. And then piecing together, to put all the parts in place to be able to make a movie, all the stars, all the additional financing, you know, everything that comes into play. It's a juggernaut to actually get a movie made, especially these days with all of the legalities that come along with it. What does the market want? What are those needs? And how well are those going to show, you know, in audiences, whether it's on screens or in streaming? So it does take a lot. It is a long process, and having us, you know, go out there on a regular basis as Film Louisiana and as a large group showcasing what the state can offer really goes a long way in promoting what it is that we have in the state and why they want to come to the state of Louisiana.
Where's this going to be 5 years from now, 10 years from now? You got capital investment. You got to be looking at this.
Absolutely. You know, we're looking at the changes and what's happening, the technologies that are changing, the use of, you know, virtual volume screens, the uses of helpless production is really kind of, you know, utilizing the new tools of AI, and really where we're going to be headed in the storytelling phase. Are people really going to be looking at, you know, CGI and AI on a regular basis, that they're going to get, you know, really kind of done with that and maybe want to go more towards human realism and more reality? Who knows? There's a lot of things that are being just kind of looked at on a regular basis, really quickly and rapidly changing basis. So it's very interesting at this moment.
Man, I hope so. I don't want to see any movie with green screen, this, that, CGI, nothing. Give me real actors and put them on location. That's what I want to see. Thank you, Jason. Appreciate it. Jason Wagensback, president of Film Louisiana. We'll talk to Eugene Green when we come back. New Orleans City Council member. Time now, WWL First News. For that, we go to Ian Ozan. All right, 7:46, 14 till 8, joined by council member Eugene Green. Congratulations on a re-election, council member.
Good morning. Thank you very much. I'm always pleased when I have an opportunity to talk to you, and so we'll be talking for the next 4 years.
Yes, sir. That's good. Let's talk about. Look, I get somebody to text me 1,000 times each day, and I don't mean that I mind it. I'm just saying they're very involved. And first thing they wanted me to ask you is that you're part of the problem. City Hall has a spending problem. It's the council's fault. It's not the administration's fault. The payroll's too high. On and on and on. Your response to that, sir?
Well, the bottom line is that the city council budgets according to mayor's requests and goals, and also ours when we've had communication. So at the end of the day, when a budget is turned in and it's approved, it is fair for the city council to assume that unless someone comes back to us and says we have a need to change this budget, that the line items are being followed. I think that you're going to certainly find that the most important thing is that certain line items weren't followed according to what was budgeted for those line items, and it lingered too long. For example, we had significant police overtime, we have significant fire overtime, and no one's saying that that's not part of a system. But at the end of the day, you have to come back and make adjustments. And then there are some things that have happened. I understand that the public recognizes that, you know, this is a very serious issue. But we did have a terrorist incident followed by a Super Bowl, followed by an incredible Mardi Gras, which was under the SEER 1 designation by the federal government. There were some things that we had to do in terms of overtime to keep our citizens safe, but also to satisfy some of the concerns of the federal government, also just the concerns of our city in general. So we did those things. We spent significant money in areas of overtime. We weren't aware that the overtime spending was getting to the point where it was damaging our ability to balance the budget. So now we've got to make an adjustment.
And you know, the person texts in again. I don't want to make this whole thing about this person, but about the payroll at City Hall is far too high, et cetera, et cetera. But if you start cutting the payroll, you're going to have to eliminate positions. If you eliminate positions, that eliminates services by reason, does it not?
Yeah, it's easy for people to say that. And, you know, it's important to know the facts. So do you want us to cut police, for example, because payroll is too high? We don't have the complement of officers that we would like to have. So many times those officers have to work overtime. Just on Sunday past and Monday past, you saw that we had to engage a significant number of officers in overtime fashion to keep our citizens safe during a concert that took place over two nights that in other cities, well, at least Atlanta, they canceled the concert. Those are the kind of pressures that exist in our city that are sometimes unable to be seen. And when you have events such as that terrorist event, you not only mobilize police, but you mobilize fire, you mobilize EMS to be prepared to make sure that an event like that doesn't happen. That's not the only reason, but it's important to recognize that I've been on the city council for 4 years. This is the first year that we're talking about this sort of budget deficit. And it's the first year that we're very honestly going to have to make those cuts that are necessary to bring the budget in line. But for everyone who's listening, for everyone who needs to know, we have to submit a balanced budget, and we're going to do so. We're going to propose different measures today. But the most important thing is at the end of the day, on December the 1st, the city of New Orleans is going to have a balanced budget. There'll certainly be more oversight. We do have a new mayor coming in. I think that it's going to be a little bit easier to conduct that oversight. But the bottom line is that we're going to make sure that certain line items are followed, or at least the department comes back to us to ask for the required budget adjustment.
For people that aren't in a council member, talk about line items and what it is that you're talking about.
For example, if the entire city budget has a line item of $13 million for police overtime. The funny thing is we didn't really budget much police overtime mm-hmm. because nobody expected we'd have the issues that we're having now.
Yeah, it was like 50,000 or something, wasn't it? Wasn't it crazy?
Right.
Yeah, go ahead.
Right. But as soon as the terrorists struck and as soon as it was known that we were going to have issues with regards to preparation for Super Bowl, preparation for Mardi Gras, preparation for other events, we couldn't use as an excuse that we don't have enough officers to put our officers in place where they need to be, or that we don't have enough EMS workers to be prepared for eventualities that might not have happened in the past. So we had to provide those services. Those services weren't line items. They weren't identified in the amount that was spent. And so now at the end of the day, we're coming up to that issue. But look, it's beyond just overtime. We focus a lot on overtime. There are some things that we have to consider as a council. For example, the New Orleans City Council made a very deliberate decision to not raise taxes by not rolling forward its millage, because at the time we were hearing so many concerns that assessments were going up, that people were going to be taxed out of their homes. So we made a decision, which didn't really inure to our benefit in many ways, to not raise taxes, not roll forward the millage. But if you have increased expenditures in many areas, not just police overtime, but in other areas too, then one day you get to this point where you have to make the adjustment that is necessary to balance the budget. And that's what we're going to have to do.
So tell me about long-term and short-term solutions.
Long-term and short-term solutions are going to include a combination of potential cuts in certain areas. Every area of city government has been asked to submit a budget that is 30% lower. And of course, every time we have a hearing, we hear how that's going to be so detrimental to the city of New Orleans. But today we're going to propose a measure which includes selling of bonds to make sure that we have the revenues necessary, or we have the assets available to make sure that our payroll for our city workers, which is of top priority. Remember, city workers include police, fire, emergency medical services, coroner services, and the like. We're going to make sure that we're not having layoffs in those areas, that we're not having furloughs in that area, and it makes us have to take on a bit of additional debt until we can write our budget.
Are there services that you think are likely to be cut that people should prepare for?
It is our goal that the level of services will continue, but of course, if you're asking for a 30% cut in each area, unless the revenue forecast comes back and says something else, you can imagine that there will be cuts in certain areas, such as responses to 311 calls. We respond to 30,000 of those a month. We may not be able to do so. But the bottom line is that there will be cuts in services in all areas, but it's important to recognize that we're not finished this process yet. We're identifying revenue measures. We're identifying revenue that might be available because it was in the coffers of other departments. This budget deficit has required the chief administrative office to take a strong look at potential sources of revenues, because, of course, the last thing we want is to burden residents unless we have to do so. So the bottom line is that we'll know more over the next couple of weeks. This budget process has still 2 weeks to go. No, multiple weeks to go, a little bit more than two.
So is the mayor, are you disappointed that the mayor's not more actively involved in this?
Well, the mayor is involved with discussions with our budget chair, but the bottom line is that I recognize that there's a big transition going on, and the mayor has submitted budgets that are 30% less in every department. So the mayor may not be making public pronouncements relative to it, but each of the department heads that is presented to us knows that there has to be cuts in certain areas, and that's at the request of the administration.
Councilman, I always admire people who try to improve the vocabulary of the audience and myself, and I give you credit for inure. I don't think anybody has ever used that word before. Thank you, sir.
All right. I'll look
have a good
to
day.
Talk to you soon. All right,
you
a lot
bet.
Over these years.
Thank you, sir. Eugene Green, New Orleans City Council member, inure. Look it up. 7:55, 5 till 8, traffic now, WWL. Well, he is a professor practicing in the Department of Criminal Justice at Loyola. He was the former head of the Super NOPD. He was the former head of the Washington State Police, head of the Washington City Police. He started pounding a beat. He went to horses, to motorcycles, then he rose up to be the eventual head of the department. He knows his stuff. He's on TV occasionally, national TV. He consults other departments. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome, if you will, the tallest man I know, Ronald Surpass. How you doing?
And good morning to you, Tommy, the most successful daytime radio talk show in the city of New Orleans.
Well, that's a lot to say, and I appreciate it, even though it is true. Let's talk about I got a couple of different things I want to pick your brain about. These phony reports, the phony report of the shooter in Lakeside Shopping Center, how dangerous something like that can be, Chief.
We've seen a lot of that around the country in its most extreme form. It's called swatting, where they will call 911 and say that someone's being held hostage or someone is in a house shooting at people. And the swatting thing has oftentimes taken form against known people like politicians or others. Incredibly dangerous. Fortunately, I think without doubt that the police are always prepared when they get any kind of emergency call like that. And given the sense that you don't get too many SWAT calls in the phone system, if you will, they're probably much more on guard. What happened at Lakeside? I was out of state all week at the police chief's conference. Mm-hmm. You know, about 30,000 of us gathered to talk about policing. So I'm not too sure what happened at Lakeside.
When it comes to Young Boy and the concert that they had here, we saw the video of the police kind of grabbing him, and he was not arrested. The police are doing that for his own safety. You don't have a problem with anything that the NOPD did, right? And I don't think he should have a problem with it either.
Not from what I can see. I'm sure the NOPD was prepared for it. The Young Boy concerts have had instances of violence in several of his venues, according to public reports. As a result of that, I'm sure the NOPD was prepared for that. And it's likely that they were, because usually that number of officers with a specific direction and action just don't fall out of the sky. I would suggest that the NOPD was prepared and ready, and if that event occurred, they were going to be there to help. They were there to protect him, and they were there to protect the crowd. So unless something happens you and I don't know about, I don't think anybody would have an issue.
Let's talk about physical requirements when it comes for police officers, because I got an email over the week about next time you talk to Ronald Surpass, ask him about officers being in shape or out of shape, et cetera. Do you feel as though the physical requirements for NOPD are where they should be?
I think so. I mean, look at it this way. When I joined in 1980, the year before, Linda Buchek, a female who was maybe about 5'5", she had successfully argued to the court that the Civil Service Commission rules for height was discriminatory towards women. But when I was the chief of the state patrol, I found out that you had to be over 6 foot to be a male trooper or a female trooper in Washington and in California. So those are relics of an older time where you had to be taller. Secondly, being in physical shape is a responsibility because you're there to protect other people. However, not unlike the military, I think a lot of police academies then and now might take someone who's not particularly in the best shape, but during the 6 months of training, there is physical training every day to bring them up to a level where they can feel confident. Tommy, the bottom line is this. If you feel confident physically with your strength, with your stature, and the training you've received, you're just likely to be scared when you confront people, and you're more commonly able to deal with it in a way that results in less force. All that ties together.
Let me take a break. We'll pick it up. We come back taking a deep dive into crime, as we always do, with Ronald Surpass, professor, practice, Department of Criminal Justice at Loyola. You got any questions, comments, 504-260-1870. We'll talk about overtime. We come back as well and managing that. Traffic now, WWL. Talking with former NOPD Superintendent Ronald Surpass, the city has massive budget problems. Chief, you were involved in this as the NOPD Superintendent. One thing I don't get is that when the mayor submitted the budget originally, knowing the Super Bowl was coming, knowing that Mardi Gras was coming, they had like $50,000 in there for police overtime. Should somebody have caught that, or is that just a crazy low number? Because that just seems silly to me to think $50,000 of overtime is going to go nowhere. One officer could eat that up in a year.
Well, the city of New Orleans has historically, all the way back to the 1990s when I was doing the budget, would create a budget authorized funding for, let's say, 1,200 cops, mm-hmm. knowing they only had 900. So those 300 cop positions that were filled by budgetary action create an overtime bank. They also create an overtime opportunity to recapture that money for other city agencies towards the end of the year. Phenomenally common. What Councilmember Singleton did is when he found out we were spending that vacant overtime dollar without them knowing what they was doing, he put a freeze on it. And we had to go every quarter and ask for that part of the vacant salaries that we could use for overtime. That's called legislative control of the money they gave to the city. Now, 50,000 in overtime, I would have to be sure that that was a single line item attached to that. But I do know this, using vacant positions, and it's not just New Orleans, but managing overtime is like managing waking up every day. You shouldn't be surprised.
Mm-hmm.
There are no excuses that I'm aware of in the history of my career where an agency head would say to the governor or the mayor, I'm sorry, we spent over by 45%. Didn't mean to do it. Can you help us out? That's just not how it works in rationally organized governments.
Presuming there's not some
have to do both.
Presuming there's not some kind of extraordinary event, right?
Absolutely, but that's contemporaneous. That's happening as you do it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think we have any example of extraordinary events beyond the horrible tragedy of January. And then everything else is like the normal day-to-day grind of the uniqueness of being New Orleans.
Mm-hmm.
Mardi Gras, Sugar Bowl, Super Bowl, second-line parades on the weekend. This is all incredibly very predictable. The unpredictable amount of overtime does come from the tragedy of January 1st, or does come from a very bad event over a weekend. But to be the tens of millions of dollars that's being reported that the police department is responsible for may have more to do with at some point the vacant salaries didn't continue to occur. Tommy, this is how it worked. Again, I got 900 people working for me, but they give me authorized strength of 1,200, which means there's money for 1,200 people, knowing I'm only going to spend 900. So that gap creates overtime use. What the city of New Orleans historically did, I don't know what they do now, but at the end of the year, Big Jim Singleton would start gathering everybody's overtime that wasn't spent and try to balance the budget by the end of the year. Very common. Other cities do it. But nobody should be surprised about how much overtime you spend. Captains should have an allotted balance. If they spend over it, they should be explaining to their chiefs why they are. If the sergeants and lieutenants are approving overtime without consistent understanding of what is the limit of how much we have, then next thing you know, those two things and other things start to add up, and it's like, uh-oh, we have a problem. Not exactly sure that's what's happening here, but I do know this. No one should be surprised about an overtime budget that overran. No one should be surprised about an overtime budget that overran its beginning balances. That's just wrong.
And finally, correct number of police officers in New Orleans. There are people that would do surveys to determine, based on call response time, what number we should be shooting at.
I do it all over the country for the last 11 years. I would not want to do it in New Orleans for fear that it would be, you know, attacked as a parochial thing.
Mm-hmm.
But if you continue to say we should have 1,200 cops, you don't know how you got that number. It forces demoralization and it creates a moving target that can't be met. Get someone who knows how to do this. Compare the workload to the officers available so that you have a level set expectation of how many cops you need. That's a budgeting tech.
Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $200 into something bigger when you bet on Moneyline, Spread, Totals, Player Props.
$200 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In app only.
It's not coming from Brent Veach and Andy Reid, and it's not coming from Sean McVay. It's coming from the Cleveland Browns. And
yeah.
You're seeing exactly
you know
what
why
people
it's not,
outside of Cleveland
you know,
think of the Browns, outside of Browns.
You know why
fans.
It's not coming from those guys? Because they didn't draft him. They didn't want him to begin with. This was the one team that wanted him, and they're telling you he's behind. Maybe it's not a grand conspiracy. Maybe everybody is right, and the Shador fans, you wackos. Maybe it's your guy is just not ready. Maybe you got to come to grips with it.
The Ken Carmen Show with Anthony Lima on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Dr. Mary Claire Haver, and my new podcast, Unpaused, is the place for bold, unfiltered conversations about what it takes for women to thrive in the second half of life. Listen to and follow Unpaused, available now wherever you get your podcasts.
That's required. That's a communication technique with your employees that's required. And mostly important, it's a communication technique with your community that you know how many you need. That's the number we're going for, and we're not going to quit chasing this cultural artifact or myth of how many people we should be.
Thank you, Chief. Appreciate your time as always. We'll talk about some cameras and classrooms in Jefferson Parish for special ed classes right now. Time for WWL First News. For that, we go to Ian Ozan. 8:47, quickly to Shane Mack, Louisiana State Representative, about his bill that would require cameras in classrooms throughout the state for special ed and special needs students. Good morning, Representative. How are you?
Hey, good morning. I'm doing good.
Thanks for taking the time with us. Tell me why it was so important to you that this bill get passed.
Well, the people, I mean, the parents and the children, you know, my heart just goes out to the children with exceptionalities. And we recognized an opportunity, you know, where there were some cases where, you know, seclusion and restraint wasn't being handled quite right. And it was just important to work to improve the educational experience for the children with exceptionalities in the school system.
Does this have anything to do with, I have a teacher and a family, and I know sometimes, you know, each special ed student has to have a lesson plan, right? And sometimes I don't know that the schools always follow through on that. Does this have anything to do with that at all, Representative?
Well, it was really just more about, you know, just making the educational experience better. You know, I mean, it just felt like, you know, we needed more training in the school systems, you know, for those that are, you know, tasked with managing the overall care and managing the overall behavior of the children, you know, so that, you know, the children just had a good educational experience, you know. So that's really what it was about.
Let's talk about what exactly the bill calls for.
Well, it calls for improvements whenever, you know, restraint is used in the school system and seclusion in the school system. Just for an example, I mean, you know, if restraint is necessary, you know, it reduced the number of minutes a student can be held from 5 to 3 before it counts as restraint. It requires school nurses and their designee to check on students after, you know, restraint or seclusion is, you know, is used. It improved the notification process to parents, you know, and added notification to the special ed directors, you know, and the parents. You know, I worked in industry for many years, and to me, in order to have a good process in place and handle you know, emergencies and situations well, it takes a lot of training. And to me, it was just important to ensure that training was in place. Go ahead.
Well, did you get any pushback on this at all from anybody, from any quarter?
Well, you know, that was one of the great things about this bill. You know, everybody that I worked with, you know, that had concerns, it was really all about everybody working together to enhance the children's school experience. You know, as far as pushback, if somebody had a question or a concern, it was really about making the bill better, you know, so that it would improve the experience that children had in the school system. Mm-hmm.
I think this also protects the teacher because, again, having a teacher and a family, I don't think people realize sometimes how big a fifth grader or a sixth grader can be, right?
100% correct. You know, and to me, you know, I'm a big public school supporter. Mm-hmm. You know, and to me, if I was a teacher in the school system and I was, you know, tasked with managing the care and behavior of a student, you know, I would want as much training as I could. And, you know, one of the big benefits that this bill did was, you know, college students going to seek educational degrees. You know, it requires that the curriculum be changed so that all the teachers, you know, that's going to be going to you know, get an education and become a teacher or train when it comes to crisis intervention training, you know, and it also, you know, required that schools form crisis response teams. And these are the ones that, you know, that should be responding to these events, you know, unless it's an emergency situation, you know, and it was just an incredible experience working with everybody to just improve the experience that the children have at the school system. That's good.
I don't think the average person realizes the sacrifice that people make that deal with special ed students, and but for them, where these kids would be. Do you?
I 100% agree with you. And I want to say that, you know, if you're a teacher and you teach students with exceptionalities, to me, your heart's got to be in it, you know, because it's just, it's a lot of hard work involved, you know, and to me, your heart's got to be in it. And that's really what this bill was about, you know, was about making sure that, you know, we helped the teachers be able to provide the care and education for the students that they cared about, you know. So that was a big factor in writing the bill and working on the bill.
Thank you, Representative. Appreciate your time, Shane Mack, Louisiana State Representative, 853, 7 till 9. Traffic now, WWL. Thank you, sir. Keith Hinckley joins us now, President of Plaquemines Parish. How you doing, sir?
I'm doing good. Tell me, how about you, man?
I am okay. Let's talk about saltwater intrusion and what's going on with that first.
Well, Tommy, on the West Bank side down in Boothville, we've probably been under the saltwater intrusion since, I would have to say, end of June, July, something like that. But, you know, one of my goals after our first 2 years in office, you know, every year we kept getting better at it. Mm. And this year, you know, the goal was to be under saltwater intrusion and our residents would never be affected by it. And this year we were successful at that. Because we're able to push water all the way from Bell Chase through Port Sulphur all the way to the Boothville Venice plant so that they have good potable and drinking water and usable water all up and down on the West Bank side of the Plaquemines. And we haven't gotten under salt water in the Point Lahash area, but we have an RO set up over there, an LDH. It's been approved. We've passed all the tests, so we're good to go. And LDH is asking us to constantly to continue running our water through that reverse osmosis machine in Point Lahash. So right now we're doing good. No problems.
Yeah, not the case with the bridge. We got to, you know, I know, of course, obviously what's going on, and you do too, Keith, with the bridge. But let's tell the story of the Bell Chase Bridge from the beginning for people that don't deal with the bridge, don't live in Bell Chase, maybe live on the North Shore or in Kenner, the city, et cetera, et cetera. Take me back to the story of this Bell Chase Bridge, if you will, please, the beginning.
Well, the Bell Chase Bridge is there because back in the 40s, 50s, a canal was dug by the federal government, and a tunnel was built, a bridge was built later on, all on the nickel and the backs of Plaquemines Parish residents. And here we are now where we sit today, a P3 project that was created in the previous administration, you know, with the John Bell administration. And it just seems like there was no oversight over what plenary could do. They just allowed them just to get away with just really some criminal acts, as far as I'm concerned, when you can charge a toll, but then there was no mention of any kind of administrative fees or anything like that. And the amount of fees that they were charging, when your tolls equal up to, say, like $5.2 million, and then the fees and the penalties were up to like $6.3 million, and that would never go towards paying down the cost of the bridge.
How important is that? Was the construction of that bridge to Plaquemines to begin with? Let's just talk about, you know, I know you talked about 3P, public partner, private ship, private,
right.
Public partner,
right.
Private ship. You could actually add another P to that, which would be plenary, which would be a 4P yeah. project. But let's talk exactly. about the importance of the bridge replacing the tunnel and the drawbridge.
Well, here's where we were. The tunnel was pretty much at its lifespan. It was done. And I believe that at that time, somewhere in the near future, the bridge only had like a, this was like four years ago, it had another, it only had 10 years left on its lifespan. Mm-hmm. So at one point, we were going to be sitting here with a tunnel that couldn't be used and a bridge that would be decommissioned as well. Without any way to get over, only, you know, through the Algiers, the Orleans Parish Bridge. So it was huge. It's major. And you know what we're feeling? It's not only affecting Plaquemines Parish, these tolls and these ludicrous fees that they're, this is affecting the whole West Bank side of the river, Jefferson Parish, Plaquemines Parish, Orleans Parish, for that matter. You know, there's businesses that they may have a route that they take. You know, they may come over the Algiers Bridge and then go over the Belchase Bridge, businesses to have their route to be most efficient. Well, this would have to make you go zigs back and forth and so forth. So this had a major, major impact on the economics of the West Bank side of the New Orleans metropolitan area.
Well, the price was crazy, too, if you didn't have a transponder, right?
Yeah, that's true. And look, I don't even know the numbers, Tommy, because they're all over the place.
Well, they're taped up now, Keith. That's a good thing.
And look, and I got to tell you, you know, I had a little mishap with my arm, so I'm in physical therapy.
Oh, no.
Young lady, Megan, she's like, you know what, Mr. Keith, it would be really nice if they were to cover up those signs. It would send a message to the people. I said, Megan, you know, that's not a bad idea.
I was waiting for it, because let me tell you what I thought. Where are you going? Access, what is the name of it?
Epic.
Yeah, right. that's where I went to when you said Megan. That's what made me think of that. But, no, I thought about that very thing, Keith, because what I was thinking is, they're still taking pictures of license plates. At some point, they're going to challenge us in court as plenary, and if they win, then they're going to go back and hit people with God knows how much in fines for tolls that they didn't pay. Do you know if they're still taking pictures or not?
It seems like they are.
Okay.
I would have to verify that, because when you go over, you can see it's like there's flashing
right.
coming and going and all. And I'm going to be honest with you. I truly believe I've got faith in Governor Landry. Look. He's not happy with this deal. From day one, from the time that he got into office, every time I had an opportunity to speak with him, he goes, Keith, I know. It's a bad deal. It's a bad deal. And I got to tell you, look, he worked well with me and with the parish on the diversion, but this is one where we couldn't kick that can down the road, because the diversion was going to hurt our community, you know, many years into the future. This was hurting our residents and our businesses today, or that, you know, 2 weeks ago. So we couldn't kick that can. And he knows, and he knows that it was a bad deal and is a bad deal. I truly believe Governor Landry is not going to let anything like that happen to any of the residents. And it's not only Plaquemines Parish, Tommy. Again, it's all over the West Bank. Because, you know, I talk to folks every day that they have their grandkids, their parents live in Belchase, but you know, they have family members in the Gretna, Jefferson Parish area. So it's a good bad thing, because it's much larger than, say, our 25,000 that we have here in Plaquemines Parish. It encompasses, you know, the whole West Bank, which now it puts us in the 60,000 to 70,000 range of people that it's affecting.
One thing that I don't understand as well is, with the LNG plant down there, you would think, if anything, that Plaquemines would be at the top of the list for the state building a bridge to facilitate all of that traffic, right?
You know, I'm going to tell you, Representative Bro is on top of that. Yes, he is. So, look, we've got great representation up in Baton Rouge right now with Senator Connick and Representative Bro. Look, I have all the faith in the world with them. I pretty much talk with Rep. Bro on a daily basis. I would talk to Senator Connick on a daily basis. But, man, when all this went down, he was lucky to be able to go to Italy for 18 days. I don't know if he's back yet or not. But we've still been talking to him about every other day, even though he's been in Europe.
Mm-hmm.
But they are steady working this. And you know, just like I made a comment yesterday on one of the news networks, is that we still don't know what it cost.
Let me take a break, because I want to pick it up there when we come back. How do you go about unpacking all of this? Because how do you get out of it? Because somebody's going to have to pay for the bridge. I understand that. I don't know if plenary's right. out of pocket on this. I don't know if the state's out of pocket on this. But I understand that you can't expect plenary to build a bridge and walk away. However, the deal that they signed going into, what, 30 years? How long is this?
It would have been 30 years.
It's crazy. So we'll pick it up with Plaquemines Parish President Keith Hinckley when we come back. If you've got any questions or comments, 504-260-1870. Tommy Tucker taking a break, back in a flash on WWL. 925, Tommy Tucker, WWL, talking to Parish President of Plaquemines Parish, Keith Hinckley, about the Belchase Bridge debacle and where we stand with that. Somebody texted in, Keith, said, I'm confused. They run a company with five trucks. I've been getting told toll tickets in the mail to pay. Should I be paying them or not? I keep getting them, and I keep tearing them up and shredding them because I've written them a letter saying I have no intention of paying this until we figure out what the hell is going on. What should people like him and me do?
Hey, do what I do. I'm not paying them.
There you go.
Okay, it's bottom line right there.
I called.
Go ahead. I did have some tolls from the past. I may go in and pay the tolls that were on the that I owe, but I'm not paying any fees or administration fees or penalties or anything like that. So
see, and that's the thing. I had tolls that were racked up, but they had my license plate on record, so they said at one point they would, when I signed up for the transponder, that they would cross it over and match it up. And I even sent them a letter saying, you got my license plate, you got the transponder number, just pay the toll out of that. But I got nowhere with it at all. And that's part of the problem, right?
It was all screwed up. Because, look, I was getting tolls in the mail for vehicles and trucks that I don't even own. So, I mean, look, that's me.
Tell me about what a buyout would look like, or where that money would come from, and how much did they? Because here's the deal, right? So I don't know who oversaw Plenary building this bridge. Before we get to how much it costs, let's talk about some of the problems that they've had with it and continue to have with it.
Yeah, there's still a problem, from what I understand, on the northbound lane on the north side of the bridge. It's starting to sink again. And there was a grant that was gotten. There was some monies that were from the federal government that were to be paid back by a new source of income. And a new source of income at the time was a toll. Mm-hmm. Well, we need to find another new source of income. And then that's where I'm leaning heavily on Senator Connick and Rep. Bro.
From the state.
Yeah. And look, and if we end up having to pay a toll at the end of the day, it's got to be... We have to know that it's 25 cents for the residents. It might be 50 cents for non-resident. It might be a dollar for a commercial. It's got to be definitive. And it's just like years ago when you'd cross the Crescent City Connection or you'd cross the causeway. I'm sure there were administrative fees involved with those tolls, but it came out of the toll. They figured it out that way. They didn't add on these exorbitant fees and expenses.
So is the end result likely to be no tolls or diminished tolls, or do you know?
Well, I really don't know right now, Tommy. I don't have that answer. My goal is no tolls. And if we do have to have tolls, they will definitely have to be diminished tolls.
Tell me about
more definitive.
The role of who is it that's administering this thing? Is it Plenary, or is it the people that administer the transponder? Well, because they have an office now set up in Belchase. What's going on there?
Well, they do have that office. GoPass has an office set up in building 600 at our government complex. But it's like, I think Rep. Rowe uses this reference all the time. We've got the fox, or my parish, the attorney, we got the fox guarding the hen house here. You got Plenary, which hired a company or created a company called Captious. So they have oversight over themselves. It's bad all the way around.
Tell me about the chances that there would be any back tolls collected on any of this for people that are texting in and wondering.
Because we mentioned. I can't say, but I'm going to tell you what, I will fight that, Tommy. And I don't believe the governor's going to allow that to happen. So I say, it's a debacle up to this point. I've always felt like this, they needed to shut it down, figure it out, and then you either move forward one way or the other, either it being paying the bridge off or coming up with fair and equitable, a process and tolls to get in and out of the parish.
Is this class action lawsuit going to help or hurt? Do you know?
I'm not in favor of this lawsuit, Tommy. Being in business, and any business owner knows this right here, is that anytime you get an attorney involved in something, regardless of what kind of business you're in,
all of a sudden you may be at the table in good faith trying to come to a solution, and all of a sudden when the attorneys get involved, you clam up. I know I would clam up because mm-hmm. I would just say, look, Mr. Tucker, you've got your attorney. I'm going to have to get my attorney. Now they're going to have to deal with each other. You know, I truly believe this lawsuit could have been something that could have happened further down the road because the governor is working on this right now. This is exactly what he is trying to do. He is not going to let that Ms. Canova have to pay a $6,000 fees and tolls. You follow me, Tommy? Mm-hmm. It's like he is working on that right now. And this lawsuit, from my understanding and talking with some attorneys, this could take years. This could take a minimum of 5 years down the road.
How long are those signs going to stay taped up with the tolls? Do you know?
I don't know. You know, it's my understanding last week the governor met with plenary. That was a very preliminary meeting mm-hmm. with them. And they're supposed to be coming back to the governor, I think, now in about, say, maybe another 2 to 3 weeks with some solutions and with what they think are equitable terms. And then at that time, there's an act and a law that was created. It's called the Administrative Protection Act, which when plenary or any company came to this DOTD with their tolls, their fees and all, there was supposed to be a committee that was supposed to be created to review all of those tolls and those fees. That never happened. They never did create that. And in that law, in that act, it doesn't say would, could have, should have. It said shall. Okay. So we're of the opinion, my attorneys with the parish, we're of the opinion that that committee should have been created so that they could take a look at all of these fees and say, hey, is that good or is that bad? That never happened. And we feel like that should happen at the end of the day, too. So, you know, that could take several months to happen as well.
Somebody texted
There's a lot of moving parts here, Tommy.
Yeah,
a
I bet. About speaking of moving parts, about the directions on the bridge and the traffic flow, is that DOTD or is that plenary or is that Plaquemines Parish who's doing that? Because specifically, they want to know about making a U-turn at the bottom of the bridge, which seems like a terrible idea to me, but it is legal. Thoughts on that? Who does all of that, Keith?
Well, that goes back to DOTD, the design of the bridge, okay? Mm-hmm. But plenary, right now, they control the flow of traffic and the closing of lanes and so forth and so on right now because it's still under construction. The construction on the bridge isn't supposed to be completed until mid-January.
Mm. And what about, is there more sinking or not, or do you know?
I don't know for a fact, but just in listening to Senator Connick, he made reference to that there's some more sinking on the northbound lane on the north side of the bridge.
Well, I know you're on top of it. Any final thoughts?
No, I just want to say this. For my granddaughter, Kate Marie, look, Plaquemines Parish is right over the bridge. We're open. There's no tolls. Just good times.
Come on over and visit. And look, for all the business owners in Plaquemines, too, Salvo's and Adams Catfish and all those places, man, I don't want to leave anybody out. But don't let the tolls keep you away because all of that's been suspended. The signs are taped up.
Business is booming for them right now, Tommy. It's a good thing when you go to these restaurants now, man. It's great. B&B, he had a full house one day this weekend, and so people are coming back into the parish here. And it is my goal right now, and it's incumbent upon me. I've got to keep fighting to keep this going in the direction that I think we're going in, and do what's right for the people of Plaquemines Parish, and it's doing what's right for the people of the West Bank side of the metropolitan area.
Well, tell Megan thank you because I was glad to see the tape go up on those signs as well or whatever it was. Thank you, Keith.
No, thank you, Tommy.
Appreciate
it. Have a good day, man.
You too. All Keith Hankley, president of Plaquemines Parish. We're going to take a break, talk about the Pelicans who get their season started tonight when we come back, 9:35, 25 till 10. Traffic now, WWL. All right, 9:42, 18. Until 10 o'clock here on WWL, NBA basketball is here. WWL is your home for your New Orleans Pelicans basketball. The Pels regular season begins today, tonight, and catch a Pels at the Memphis Grizzlies. Tonight, pregame 6:30, tip-off 7 on both the Big 870, WWLA, MN 105.3 FM, WWL. Ali Cosell joins us now, our friend, a credentialed NBA writer covering the Pelicans. Happy NBA season, Ali.
Good morning, Tommy. Yes, and thank you. I'm ready to get this redemption tour of the New Orleans Pelicans started.
I like it. I like it, the redemption tour. Let's talk a recap for people that are casual fans about what happened in the offseason and preseason for the Pels.
Yeah, after losing 21 games last year, one of the worst seasons in franchise history, the organization smartly decided to make major changes, and to start with front office. They brought in Joe Dumars, out went David Griffin, and Joe Dumars brought in several of his own people in the front office, including people like Troy Weaver, who have run other basketball operations before, like with the Detroit Pistons. So they remade the roster where there's only 8 players returning from last season's team. So brought in a couple of new rookies, high lottery picks in Jeremiah Fears and also Derek Queen. And then, of course, you made a trade, big trade. C.J. McCollum was traded to the Washington Wizards. And in return, you got Sadiq Bey, who's going to, I think, be a great reserve for this team, along with Jordan Poole. So you've got so many fresh faces now next to Zion Williamson, Trey Murphy, and Herb Jones. So it'll be interesting to see how it works out. But I'll tell you what, so far it looks good, right? The vibes are very good. And in preseason, the team looked really good at times.
Tell me about who's available and who's not.
Yeah, so that's one of the better storylines for the Pelicans. You've got almost the entire roster available, including Derek Queen, who hasn't seen any preseason action, but he's available to play today. Not sure how much run he'll get, but the fact that the Pelicans are very thin at center, Kevon Looney is one of the players out alongside DeJounte Moore and likely Carlo Matkovich. You're going to probably see Derek Queen get some run, but yes, almost everybody else is available, ready to go.
DeJounte Murray too?
Yeah, he's out. He's out till probably, we're guessing, Tommy, because he's still recovering from the Achilles tear
last
season.
Thought.
He's probably not. We're not going to see him for at least a few months.
All right, let's talk about the starting five. What that's likely to look like?
Yeah, so I think you can etch this in stone. It's going to be Jordan Poole, Trey Murphy, Herb Jones, Zion Williamson, and for now it's Eve Missy. I think everybody thought that Kevon Looney, who was signed during free agency over the summer, that he would probably be the starter, but since he's hurt, it's going to be Eve Missy.
I thought Eve Missy was pretty impressive last year.
There's no doubt, Tommy, he had his glimpses.
Moments.
Where
had his
he
moments.
Definitely showed his athleticism, mm-hmm. right? That length of athleticism, defending the rim running, right? But he's very young. You know, he's still very young. He's still learning the game, honestly, having only played it for 6-7 years. So I think he's the Pelican center of the future. But for right now, I think they probably wanted, like Kevon Looney, like I said, to start, because he just brings experience for a team that wants to win games now.
You got to talk about Zion Williamson. Is this his year, finally?
Oh, I hope so, Tommy. I don't know how many years we've talked about him and, you know, whether it's his conditioning, his stamina, you name it, not doing things professionally. But so far, all the signs are pointing to this will be his greatest season, right? Not only is he at his thinnest weight, he's doing all the right things. And honestly, it stems back to last year. But the fact he was able to carry some positives from last year, he started that program with the Pelicans director of performance, Daniel Bove, and getting his body right after his last hamstring injury, saying, we don't want to have this happen anymore. We've got to get this body in as best a shape as we can. They've been working on it ever since, including this summer, to where now he's down to, I think, about 260 pounds. So lightest on his feet. And in preseason, we've seen that, Tommy. In the past, he's had to conserve energy, right? Mostly using it up on the offensive end. But this season and glimpses last year, we're seeing it now defensively. I mean, if you took his numbers, his per 36 minutes, if he was to play a full game, extrapolate that, his preseason stats, he was averaging 6 steals a game this preseason. That's unheard of, but it shows you that how much he's working on that end of the floor now.
Tell me about the Grizzlies.
So the Grizzlies typically are a very good team, right? They're either one of the better teams in the West or at least in the playoff hunt. But this season, they're entering with kind of a murky situation. Ja Morant, he's going to play, but he's coming off of an ankle injury to where I wasn't sure if he'd start the season. So don't expect him at 100%. Jaren Jackson, their second best player, he's also fresh off of a knee injury. And they're also missing a slew of role players. Scottie Pippen Jr., who was great for them last year. Their starting center, Zach Edey, he's out. The guy who's replacing Desmond Bane that was traded to Orlando, Ty Jerome, he's out for at least 4 weeks or more. So they've got a lot of players out. So that's why I expect, and I'm shocked, the line says they're favored by 4.5. I think the Pelicans should be favored, even though they're in Memphis, even though they're coming off a 21-win team. I think the Pelicans just have a much more solid of a group.
How much different would it be if the Pels were in the Eastern Conference, not the Western?
I think we'd be talking about them potentially being, honestly, a top four team, mm-hmm. right? If you can get 65, 70 games out of Zion, I think they could win easily 50 games, right? 2 years ago, they won 49 games in the West. When Zion played, you know, about 70 games, it'd be much more in the East, right? Because that's a much weaker side of the NBA, right? That conference just doesn't compare to the West in terms mm-hmm. of talent.
What are some realistic expectations for Pelicans fans this year, and even for Joe Dumars going in?
Yeah, so I like to take the median route, right? Because you don't know how it's going to play out. Will Zion play 30 games, 60, or pretty much the entire schedule? You don't know. So I think realistically, you can peg them for about a 500 record, right? So that's a massive improvement from last year. But also, you're going to see greater depth. And that's what drove the success the last previous two seasons before the last one, right? They rode Zion Williamson plus depth around him. For instance, when Zion played in the first two seasons under Willie Green, the team went 59-40, Tommy. So that kind of shows you what's under the hood. So I think they can get back to it if Zion, like I said, appears in more games. And plus, you've got something for the future to look forward to now. I think Jeremiah Fears is going to be outstanding with the improvement he's already shown in preseason. And everybody's itching to see Derek Queen, but there's a lot of hopes for him as well. So you've got talent top to bottom really on this roster.
What do we know about Hunter Dickinson? He's the biggest guy on the team.
He is, and he's going to be a kind of a backup center for this squad, mm-hmm. where he actually already saw some minutes due to Kevon Looney.
Ali Cosell? I think we had a little technical problem with Ali Cosell, but I think we got a lot of it in about the Pels taking on the Grizzlies tonight. And, of course, we got all the action for you here on WWL. Ali, go ahead, finish your thought, please.
Yeah, Hunter Dickinson, five-year guy out of Kansas. He's going to be playing likely mostly in the G League for the Birmingham team, but when they need size and depth, which we saw in that last game in preseason against Orlando, he'll be able to step in.
3 weeks from now, what are we going to be talking about?
You know, I hope that the Pelicans can get off to, say, around a 500 start, because this schedule is brutal, Tommy. Because after today, Memphis, you got San Antonio with Victor Wembanyama on the rise. Then you've got the Boston Celtics, who, admittedly, aren't going to be the world champions. But after that, it's three in a row. Nuggets, Clippers, and the Thunder. Three of the top teams in the West. So, like I said, that's how the schedule has shaken out so far. If they can survive it, they're going to be in good position for the rest of the year.
What are you hearing from the fans? What are you seeing on social media about buy-in?
You know, I see that fans really like this team, honestly, because they've seen enough of the glimpses in preseason to where they're excited, right, because of all the changes made. So national media buried them, especially after that trade that brought Derek Queen to New Orleans. But since that time, it's been on the upswing, honestly.
Thank you. Any final thoughts, Ali? Your predictions?
No. I mean, my prediction, I picked them 40-42. They're going to get at least in the play-in tournament. I think they're one of easily the top 10 best teams in the West. But if Zion plays, say, more than 60 games, they're going to win more than that.
Let's hope you're right and they stay healthy. Thank you, sir. Ali Cosell, a credentialed NBA writer covering the Pelicans. Of course, we got the action for you here on WWL, your home for the New Orleans Pelicans. Pel season, regular season, begins tonight, and catch them at the Memphis Grizzlies tonight, pregame 6:30, tip-off at 7 on both the Big 870 WWL and 105.3 FM. And before that, of course, make sure you tune in at 4:30 for Quarterback to Quarterback with Bobby and Drew. Bobby Hebert, Drew Brees dissect the Saints-Bears game, preview the next home game.
Bet365 is paying out before the final whistle.
Check out Bet365's unrivaled early payout offer. When you bet on a team to win and they take a 17-point lead, you get paid no matter the final score. Forget the final whistle and start counting that cash. Hold up. You get early payout on parlays, too.
Download the app and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.
Kevin Stefanski and Andrew Berry, do you think that they are good at what they do?
Yeah, I think so. Well, Stefanski, two-time coach of the year. Andrew Berry, I don't know who. Do we blame the Haslams for the Deshaun Watson debacle?
The questions and the criticisms are more about ownership than anybody on the sideline or in the GM.
He's the head coach of a franchise owned by Jimmy Haslam, so who knows? If you put him in a more stable situation with a less volatile compound in the owner's box, maybe you'd get more.
The Ken Carmen Show with Anthony Lima on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Dr. Mary Claire Haver. Ready for honest conversations about thriving in midlife? Listen to and follow my new podcast, Unpaused, available now wherever you get your podcasts.